This is an ABC podcast.
How do the places we love shape our sense of the sacred? And how are our spiritual lives nurtured by the bush, by the mountains, even the sea?
I think the religious and spiritual sensibilities are fourfold. It's an orienting to the cosmos, it's grounding in the earth, it's nurturing in food and water, and it's transforming in our society and in ourselves. And all that is connected to the places where we live, the places that we love.
It's a very painful thing to feel and think of the sea, of how the sea is being poisoned. And because the sea is not just a point of connection, it's the location, the center of our spirit world, the world of our spirituality.
Hello and welcome to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake. It's great to be with you to explore sacred landscapes. In the wake of World Environment Day on June the 5th, we're beginning a new series today on religion and ecology. Maybe there's somewhere specific, a special place that's been important for your spirituality. Well, over the next 3 weeks, I can promise you something like a mini world tour of sacred landscapes, from the church forests of Ethiopia to the mountains of Chinese Taoism, the seascapes of Pacific theology to the forest monasteries of Theravadan Buddhism. Let's find out how religion and spirituality might matter in the Anthropocene. Mary Evelyn Tucker is the perfect person to introduce us to this whole field. She's a co-founder and director of the Forum on Religion and Ecology at Yale University. She's also a senior lecturer and research fellow there in the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, as well as in the Divinity School and the Department of Religious Studies. To begin with, Mary Evelyn, I know you are really a leader in what's now a quite an established academic field, religion and ecology. But I'm also aware that your early tertiary studies were in English literature. So how did you become engaged in what's now this field, religion and ecology? Was there an experience or maybe a question that drew you into this?
Well, thank you for that question, Meredith, and lovely to be with you. I do love literature. I think it's a powerful way that the human imagination enters into other imaginations, and that it can really light us up. And I did a master's in literature as well, especially theater and drama. I was keenly interested in that. And then I had an opportunity to go to Japan, and that's what really changed my life. And in part, I have to say, because I was very politically involved in the 60s and so on in college in Washington, D.C., and civil rights, the anti-Vietnam War, and all of that. And I was fairly disillusioned. Had worked on the McCarthy campaign and McGovern campaign and all that. And when Nixon came into office, it was a pretty bleak moment. So I was very, very fortunate to be invited to teach, actually, English literature and drama in a woman's university in Japan. And that's what changed my life into this direction, because I started studying the religions of Japan and East Asia and other parts of Asia.
I'm curious, though, about why you came to study Confucianism in particular. I know you've written 5 books or something on that particular topic. Why Confucianism?
Well, thank you for that, because not many people ask me about that. But, you know, when I was in Japan, I really got into Buddhism, as many people do, and Zen was a huge attraction, and I practiced Zen meditation and studied with an extraordinary teacher who was actually head of the Rinzai sect of Buddhism, who I met in a very small, unassuming temple near where I was teaching, and he later went on to be head of Tofukuji Temple in Kyoto. And I kept in touch with him his whole life, and he was an amazing person. And of course, I love Shinto with its animistic sensibilities and the kami, the aliveness of the world and trees and waterfalls and mountains and so on. So I love both of these traditions. But I eventually came to sense that there was an even more profound, although almost elusive, tradition in Japan, in Korea, in China, and so on. And that was Confucianism. And this was something that really combined my interest in the political order, the educational order, and nature. So Confucianism is so much less understood because there's very few books compared to Buddhism, for example, or Hinduism that have been translated. And I was very fortunate when I came back to the States. I'd written to Thomas Berry while I was in Japan, cultural historian teaching at Fordham University. And the miracle of my life is that he wrote back because I was asking then for his book on Buddhism. And I met him shortly after I came back. And I knew the moment I met him, this was my teacher. And again, it's a wow. great, great blessing to have met him. But he and his colleague, good friend at Columbia, who I later went to do my I did my master's with Thomas Berry and then PhD with Ted DeBerry, who's one of who was one of the illustrious interpreters of Confucianism to the West, and also really a founder of Asian studies at Columbia. And so Confucianism, I could go on forever, but I'll just say again, it attracted me because it has this marvelous sense of the concentric circles that the human isn't just an isolated individual, but is related to the family, to society, to the educational world, the political world, nature, earth, and the cosmos. And everything one does, including especially self-cultivation, study, and so on, actually reverberates with these other concentric circles and vice versa. How nature impacts us, how the cosmos is our ultimate home. All of this was a remarkable cosmology and very, very inspiring to me. So that's how I got into it, really through a sense of the need for something even larger than just spiritual enlightenment, which Buddhism offers, or the beauty of the animistic perspective of the Shinto tradition.
One of the other points you sometimes make about Confucianism is that millions and millions and millions of people have been influenced in their outlook, their mode of being by, well, is it a religion? Is it a philosophy? I know that's an old debate. But the footprint, if you like, of a Confucian understanding has been massive in the history of humanity and its relationships to every other element of the world we inhabit. And I wonder if that's a signal, really, of why talking about religion, if you want to consider Confucianism a religion, needs to be part of our conversation about ecology. I mean, I'd be curious about your elevator pitch, Mary Evelyn. Like, why do you think these fields of religion and ecology need to interact?
Well, Meredith, let me just pick up your very important point that Confucianism has probably influenced more people than any other tradition on the planet because of its antiquity, because of the numbers of people all across East Asia, but the Chinese abroad, throughout Southeast Asia, and many other parts of the world. And this is a tradition that all the students from East Asia who have been in my class say, oh, I never thought of that as Confucian. It's just the way we were taught. So this is a cultural DNA that's still alive in China, and we can talk about its revival in many ways. But I just wanted to underscore, yes, it is hugely influential and right down to the present, where there's a whole effort in China on ecological civilization, for example, which we could talk about, which draws on the Confucian tradition and other traditions like Taoism. But I want to say to your most important question of religions and ecology, broadly speaking, you know, John, my husband and I, he's a specialist in indigenous traditions, a student of Native American traditions in particular, and we've been very involved in the Crow tribe in Montana and the Salish peoples in Washington state. But the reason we became involved in this cross-disciplinary area is because we said we're not scientists, we're not policy people or economists or lawyers, but the cultural values around the planet are clearly what shapes societies, keeps them together, formulates both the trials and tribulations of people responding to suffering, to death, to the great challenges of human life. But all of them have extraordinary teachings on the natural world. So we said these have to be retrieved, reevaluated in light of present circumstances, and reconstructed. And that's what we began to do with hundreds of others in the Harvard Conference Series in the mid-90s. So that's the beginning of an answer to your very important question, why religion and ecology?
Mary Evelyn, I wonder if, in a sense, there's a continuity there with your early interest in literature and in drama and, well, really in storytelling. Because, yeah. I mean, the religious traditions are more than containers of values, so to speak. They orient us to our own being, to the world we find ourselves in, on a very deep level of story. Mm-hmm. And it's on that point about story that I think the problems and the promises of religion, and these are terms you've used in much of your writing, become really sharp. I wonder if we could talk a bit about that. The kind of problematic stories around nature that have been pervaded around the world in a religious form. I wonder if you'd elaborate a little bit on that. And I'm thinking, of course, of Lynn White and the thesis about the roots of our ecological crisis in a particular form of Christian theology. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, yes. So Lynn White wrote this article that was published in 1967 in Science, a very influential journal. And it's quite a short article, but it has lasted down to the present to stir people up because he was highlighting, as you know and others do, that the dominion passage in Genesis is a problem, and that the sense of Christians having control over, dominion of creation, the natural world, and so on, is truly a non-ecological, shall we say, position. Now, he also said that Christianity tended to demythologize the world, take away this sense of animism and so on. But he did highlight the Benedictine tradition and even the Franciscan tradition and so on. So he wasn't saying it's all bad, but this set off a tremendous discussion. And lasting right down to today. Some people feel it's a bit of a rabbit hole that he drew people into because, I mean, people are going beyond that. But it is, he does identify the problematic side of the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition as well in terms of dominion.
It is a rabbit hole. I've ventured down it to some degree myself in the past. But the idea of demythologizing is important, I think, partly because one of the, well, theorists of secularization, for example, talk about our own moment, and I mean kind of in the modern West, so to speak, in terms of a kind of disenchantment, this idea that we've lost touch with the mysterious aspects of the world around us. We're buffered, to use Charles Taylor's term, from, I guess, the supernatural, the unexplainable, anything really beyond the material in the way we relate to the world. That's a bigger transition that's occurred than just a religious one, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's exactly. I mean, you can say it's an Enlightenment transition, you know, of rationalism, of elevating life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but for the individual, not all life, just human life, not the rights of nature and happiness as a very materialist type of goal. And then you combine that with rationalism, you combine it with materialism, and you have a very toxic stew, actually, of the ability to exploit the sense that the natural world is dead matter and something for our use. Is very, very widespread. And science and technology, the combination thereof, without any sense of restraint or ethics. And then you put in a final spice into this stew, which is economic growth. And without limits, the notion that the GDP is what has to be grown no matter what is a huge, huge challenge. So the demythologizing of nature is an Enlightenment legacy. It is something that certainly some of the religions worried about so-called paganism or worship of nature certainly have added to. And but that combination has left us with a profoundly, almost a sense of a void of how we are connected to a living, sentient, and communicative world. I mean, look at what animal behavior is exploding since Jane Goodall and many, many others talking about the aliveness of everything from fish to birds to mammals to amphibians and so on, the communication in trees and so on. So this tremendous sense that we're recovering, fortunately, of the aliveness of the natural world and that there's differentiated sentience throughout. Yeah. So anyway, yes, I think that's been a huge severing of a relationship, leaving us quite alienated and with a lack of belonging. But I think that gap is being healed and a recovery through indigenous voices in a very powerful way is, of course, taking place now as it's been throughout their history.
Mary Evelyn Tucker from Yale University, where she's co-directed the Forum on Religion and Ecology since 1998. I'm Meredith Lake, and on Soul Search today, we've been talking about some of the problematic ways that religious ideas have played into our present ecological crisis. But I wonder what Mary Evelyn thinks the promise of religious ideas and communities might be. Why keep spirituality in view as we try and rise to the climate challenge?
Right. Well, let me pick up, of course, on the voice of Indigenous peoples and to say that I think they have one of the most luminous cosmovisions in very plural and differentiated forms to offer to this question. And you take the Indigenous peoples in Australia and the Maori peoples in New Zealand and the rights of the river in New Zealand that's been restored and so on. So the sense of place, traditional environmental knowledge, the even burnings of forests that's taking place in Australia, how this actually works, and is just extraordinary what's happening around the world in this respect. And that's very exciting. So that's the promise. And I would also say what's great about the restoration of land, of rivers, of forests that's being led in certain ways, the combination of traditional environmental knowledge and scientific knowledge is marvelous. And Robin Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass, of course, illustrates that. But I think the promise is in the other traditions as well. The Christian tradition, which of course, is much maligned for its corruptions, plural, its power moves, plural, its missionizing moves, and so on. And its history, we can all take that apart pretty readily. But I would say, Pope Francis and his encyclical letter, Laudato Si, which means praise be in early Italian, and draws on St. Francis with a love of nature and this combination, yes, cry of the earth, cry of the poor. That they've just had the sixth anniversary of Laudato Si this past week, and the literally thousands of people around the world each day on webinars on education, on finance and divestment, on liturgies and so on. This is probably the largest movement of religion and ecology to date. And I happen to be on a small Vatican committee kind of thinking through ways in which this can come forward. And I'm astounded, frankly, in what's happening in different parts of the world. So it's a really marvelous education for me. Protestant groups, the evangelical groups are coming on board, and the Orthodox with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew.
The encyclical you mentioned, Laudato Si, I remember when I read it, I'm not normally in the habit of reading encyclicals, but I was astonished and encouraged, actually, by how integrated a vision it was. But I wonder if part of what religions can contribute is I mean, there's a new kind of storytelling that's happening. I think these are signs of that, a new kind of theology, if you want to speak in Christian terms. But there's also something in terms of habituation. I mean, I think we need more than better stories. We need new ways of being, and whether ritual or the kind of the practices of religious communities might have something to add there.
Yeah, this is a shift of a world of worldviews, right? It's not just changing light bulbs. It's not only divestment, even though the religious communities account for 25% of the divestment movement of $14 trillion. So that's very significant. So there's a moral force here. That's what we're trying to activate, the moral force of transformation. But I do think, you know, our teacher, Thomas Berry, what he was saying is the liturgies of many traditions are cosmologically oriented, especially then to seasons. So we're trying to align ourselves with these larger forces. And I do think once these ideas get into liturgy, where people can both have a feeling, I like to think of it this way, of mourning with a U, mourning the loss, the biodiversity loss, the justice losses, those who are being adversely affected by climate change, the refugees and so on. So deep mourning and a deep sense of confession, even if you will, and penitence, if you will, in traditional ways. But we have to go through a rite of passage towards mourning with the sense of renewal, rebirth, and possibility. Liturgy could give us that. And the uplifting of people in these kinds of practices is very important. The low-hanging fruit is changing our carbon footprint and so on. It is entering into the divestment sphere. It is the legal cases for young people and so on, and the explosion of young voices. All of that's very doable. But there's something even more profound of this, the encyclical calls it ecological conversion or ecological spirituality. That's the long-term change that we really need, a change of consciousness and conscience. Minds and hearts, our worldviews and our ethics really shifting. And I think that's happening, actually.
Mary Evelyn Tucker is the co-founder and director of the Forum on Religion and Ecology at Yale University, and her many books engage Confucianism, Buddhism, Hinduism and other traditions, all in search of wisdom for our time and perhaps even a transformed humanity. You can find out more about all that by following the links on the Soul Search website. Right now on RN and by podcast, of course, you're listening to Soul Search and part one of a new three-part series on sacred landscapes. I'm Meredith Lake, and you know, growing up, it was always the bush that was important to me. I loved living near a national park, but I also wished we lived nearer to the beach. I still find a swim in the ocean can help to reset a bit. But let's have a closer look now at what the ocean might mean for spirituality. Because it can be much more than a place of personal refreshment or even of cleansing. The ocean can define whole communities and the ways that they make meaning. The Reverend Dr. Sione Havea is a pastor from Tonga. He works at the forefront of post-colonial hermeneutics and Pacifica theology. Sione has produced several books. The first one I think I heard about was Indigenous Australia and the Unfinished Business of Theology, but there are many more that have become landmarks, really, in biblical studies from the Pacific. I'm thrilled to have Sione on Soul Search today to find out what it means to him to belong to the islands and to their seas. To begin, I guess, I wonder if you could tell me about where you grew up. Was there a particular place or environment even that you'd say had an impact on you in a kind of formative way as a young person?
Oh, as a young person, I'm still young to an extent. And I'm still growing up. But I should say first that I'm speaking to you from the unceded land of the Wurundjeri people in the southeast part of Australia. I was born in Tonga, raised in Tonga, went to Fiji for high school. Both of those islands had impact the way I think, the way I am. And they still continue to influence me. But probably it's not one place in particular. It's how places are connected. So it's the connection between Tonga and Fiji. And that connection has some kind of heritage. I don't know if you know that in 1885, there was a group of Tongans that were what I would call exiled from Tonga to Fiji by our first king, because they didn't agree on where the church should be based. They were exiled to Fiji. So when I came to Fiji, it allowed me to grow up in the shadows of that exile, in which my paternal grandmother was in that exile. So I'm not quite sure I can pinpoint a significant place. It's whatever our word is Talanoa, whatever the story of the place is, that's what has influenced my way of thinking. And having grown up in those two places, this experience of migration, of being a Pacific Islander, but not a Fijian in Fiji. So it's a whole complex of things.
Sione, you've written about being a person, being part of a community that's in a very important way in transit. And I wonder if you could actually open that up even more, because you've written about yourself as a native rather than as an Indigenous person in terms of your connection to Tonga. Could you say what it means to you to be native in that sense that you use it?
That's a really important, thank you for that question. It's a very difficult question as well. I'm using native as a way of sticking my tongue out to the anthropologists who called our people natives as a way of downgrading them. You know, these are the natives, they are not civilized. So I decided to call myself as a native as a way of saying, well, some of us natives are okay, we can think, we can write. That's one side of it. It's playing with how maybe in Australia you call them settlers, or how the academics have caricatured our native people of the Pacific.
I have to admit that when I came across that language in your writing, I did, I guess, kind of balk a bit at it, because it can be such a pejorative term. What did you mean to kind of reclaim that term?
My intention was, and still is just to, you know, make it less toxic and invite our people to affirm that we are natives to the islands. And I intentionally don't use the word Indigenous, because that's not part of our claim as people of the Pacific. We have sayings, you know, we are sons and daughters of navigators, which is one way of saying that our ancestors came from somewhere else and they arrive in the islands and establish themselves. And in establishing themselves, they became natives. They're not Indigenous because they came from somewhere else, but we are native in the sense that we have learned to belong in the islands and to cope and to learn what it means to be islanders. So that's part of what I'm pushing for in using this label.
In talking about navigators then, the sea, the ocean, obviously comes into view. And one of the things I find so interesting about your work is the way you call attention to the sea, to the ocean, as a serious space, a space that's generative, where things matter. It's not just, you know, something that might restrict the land or be the thing that, you know, you fly over on the way to someplace else. What does the ocean then come to mean in this kind of island way of thinking that you're talking about?
I've learned to understand the ocean, and I'm still trying to understand the ocean as I have developed my thinking. At the beginning, my emphasis on the sea, on moana, was on the watery fluidity, a quality of the sea that connects island to island. So it was about how it connects us in different islands from distant islands, as well as that's our context. It's a water context. So connection and wateriness are qualities in what I in my way of thinking. So everything is fluid. There is no rigidity. There is no fixedness. But over time, I have got to understand the sea differently. I mean, at first, I was just a swimmer who goes out to enjoy the surf and the waves and the currents. Now I'm seeing the sea in a different light, especially in the last probably 5 or 6 years. If you imagine yourself, you are in a canoe, go out into the ocean, in the open sea. Being in the sea draws you to two other realms, to the sky and what's under the sea. So there is a connection between sea or moana and sky, meaning just whatever is above, and the underworld. And this awareness came recently. And then I went back to the legends and myths of our people and realized that they were always thinking in these four different spheres. Land, the dry land, and the sea are always connected. But when they are navigating, when they're moving around in the sea, they had to be connected to the sky, the stars, or the clouds, as well as to the underworld. So these four spheres, the connection between these four spheres are becoming stronger in these last few years. And it so happened that these were the years when I was beginning to work on, you know, climate change and ecological challenges. So the sea means many things. And one of it is a point of connection between islands, but a point of connection between these four spheres, these four realms in the what I consider to be the native mentality. Now, this is not unique to the people of the islands. I have learned that like Yolngu people from up north think in the same line as well. There's something that connects all of the spheres in which we live. Unfortunately, we only can live and be in one place. We can be on land. But in my case, I tried to learn how to live and behave and work on land before with the awareness of the moana, but now it's with the awareness of the underworld as well as the sky.
Sione, you're describing a way of thinking that, I mean, it's so different to the more continental way that I grew up thinking. And listening to you, it strikes me that the whole sacred, secular, nature, culture, those binaries collapse completely from the perspective that you're describing. Would you say something about the idea of the sacred or tapu in this mindset?
Tapu, it depends on, you know, I'm Tongan, so I'll define it as a Tongan. It's whatever is sacred. But then the question is, what is not sacred? In this way of thinking, everything is sacred. Your neighbor is sacred. Your neighbor's lawn is sacred. You know, that tree is sacred. The animals are sacred. So what is sacred is in everywhere. Part of the problem has been, and you know a little more about indigenous culture than I do, and the effect of colonization, is that when there was the Christian mission, let's not beat around the bushes, when the Christian missionaries came, they say, oh, your people are savages, they are uncivilized, they are darkness. We are the light. That is the Christian message. It's only because of that announcement that the sacredness of our people, they lost that tapu, they lost that sacredness. So it's because of a more dominant religiosity that came and established itself through the name of Christianity, that the religiosity of our people was lost or drowned. But whereas from my way of thinking, everything is sacred, but that doesn't mean that everything is therefore healthy. Because tapu has two meanings. One is about being sacred, and one is about being forbidden. And something may be forbidden because it's sacred, or something may be forbidden because it is not healthy. So when I say it's sacred using tapu, it can have these two frames of understanding.
I mean, it's the root of the English word taboo, which conveys a little bit of that sense of prohibition that you're talking about.
Right.
I think English borrows that term,
yes,
and gives it its own, you know, fills it with its own associations.
Right. And that came through the Fijian language. Tambu is the Fijian term. But it's when you understand it only as prohibition rather than being sacred, then you lose the sense of the term.
Can tapu be associated with the sea? I mean, forgive my ignorance, but how does this concept relate to a watery kind of space?
Ah, yeah, the water is on the surface. It's what's behind the surface, or under the surface, is where the tapu is for our Tongan thinking. For example, if you want to go to what we call pulotu, which is the home ground of the ancestors, you go to where the sun sets, and the sun sets into the sea. So our legend leads us to see that there is something tapu on the other side of the moana. So there is tapu in the sea as well as tapu on land as well. Like, for example, we have rituals related to death. Like if someone is ready to die, then we would hear on the beach the arrival of a vessel, a vaka, that we take to be a vaka coming to take the spirit of the one who is about to die. And then after death, and then be a few days later, we will hear the sound of the vaka going with the soul of the one who is passed. Now, this doesn't happen regularly. I have witnessed it with my own, myself. And if this is the journey, that at death, then the spirit of the dead are gathered and migrate out to sea, then for me as a Tongan, and we share this with the Samoans, then the sea, the moana, is the realm of the spirits in that regard. There are also legends about the land as the gathering place of the spirits. So it's not just a salt water and land divide. But I guess what I'm pushing for is more that tapu is everywhere rather than in just one place and not the other. Now, the other argument, one can argue that tapu is only in the sea and not on land. And to that, I will argue that the land and the sea are connected. So we can't think of only the sea as tapu without realizing that that is connected to the land as well. I think there are at least two possible arguments there, Meredith.
Dr. Sione Havea, a native pastor from Tonga, and you just heard him explain what he means by the term native there. He's a research fellow with both Trinity Methodist Theological College in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and with the Public and Contextual Theology Research Centre of Charles Sturt University here. On Soul Search on RN, we've been talking about tapu and the complex sacredness of the sea. But I want to know what all this means for Sione's work in biblical studies. The Christian scriptures were initially brought to the South Pacific by European missionaries. So what does it look like to read, to write, and tell stories about it now from a Pacifica perspective? Sione, you mentioned your grandmother being among the exiles from Tonga to Fiji. You've mentioned a little bit about the impact of European Christian missionaries in Tonga. How would you describe the presence of Christianity in your family and in your personal upbringing? What did it look like for you to be raised in that kind of environment?
That's a good question. Part of my struggle, maybe is the right word, or part of my problem is that I was born into the church. My father was a pastor. So pretty much I didn't have a choice but to be a Christian. But one of the formative things for me, growing up, we didn't have literature, children literature to learn how to read. There was only two ways where we learned to read Tongan. One was the Bible, and the second was our weekly chronicles. I think it was like 6 pages of weekly news at that time. So to learn to read Tongan, I had to read the Bible. So the Bible for me was just that. It wasn't something to help me find God or helped me with my faith. It was just, this is what we do every evening. I sit with the Bible and read it so that I can learn the language. And then after reading the Bible to learn the language, my other grandmother will tell me stories. So there was, I think, some unconscious connection between this book that was just literature at that point and my grandmother telling me about stories about spirits moving around and coming around the next day with different faces and so forth. So I was raising that. And I think this is, I say problem, maybe contradiction, that I was very conscious that my parents were working for the church. That doesn't mean that we were pious. It just only means that the church trusts them to do some work for them and for the communities. But then this holy book the church brought was just a text to be read. And then there was the grandmother who helped me think differently. I think most of the families in Tonga in my generation grew up with that until they got to the point. Some of them learned quickly that they need to have stronger faith and they moved on. But I think I'm still stuck in that early days when the Bible was just a book. So like I said at the beginning, I'm still growing here. And hopefully I won't get to that point where this book becomes too holy and prohibitive, as in tapu, but continues to be a book for thinking and reading. That is part of the way I read. I read it as literature. I'm learning to read it as scripture as well. But it's my reading are always ongoing.
Mm. It sounds like you engage the text of the Bible as a text in transit. It's not a static text by any means. You mentioned your parents. If I've got this right, I suspect your father was one of the people who is now associated with what might be called a contextual theology in the Pacific. Was it him who coined the phrase coconut theology back in the 1980s?
Yes, my father is the one that put it on paper. But he had a lot of, he was speaking on behalf of other people, to Tuilavoni from Fiji as well, for example, other Samoan colleagues. And they were working in the late 50s and 60s on this thing they call coconut theology. You're right in putting in that way that I have inherited this, well, if you think of it as a mat, this weaving that different strands have come together. It doesn't mean that I settle on a particular understanding of this theology. There's a lot of things that my father and I agreed on, and there's a lot more probably that he wouldn't endorse in the way that I do think. I mean, he was a church person. He had a concern for the community and for the nation more so than I do. I'm more pushing the limits, but we were all in this transitory nature. Frame of mind. I think being in transit is a good way of phrasing it. And you read it in one translation, it says something different. The languages as well, the Pacific languages, it's all in motion, not just my interpretations. My interpretations, my life is all in motion. It's growing. But the Bible is also in motion. That's something that I want to push at. There's a tendency to think, oh, this collection of books have been canonized, therefore the canon is closed. Well, maybe we can't add any more books to the canon, but the book itself has not decided what it means. So the text is still open for interpretation. So transitoriness is on my end as an interpreter in my community, as well as in the book itself. That's where I might be a little different from other of my colleagues who are more certain of the fixity of the text or what it means than I am. Some people have made up their minds, as you know, Meredith. I haven't quite made that up.
From the little bit I've read about coconut theology, that approach was doing more than offering a symbol, the coconut, as a way of grounding the story of Jesus. It was also an approach, as far as I understand, that suggested Pacific theology could be a theology of celebration, in contrast to a lot of, you know, the rest of 20th century systematic theology that was written in a context of crisis. I'm curious about that idea of a theology of celebration, particularly, you know, a generation on from that, given the climate crisis as a context for reading a text in motion like the Bible.
First of all, this thing about celebration was growing out of their realization that theologies like Barton, Bonhoeffer had offered came out of a context of conflict, war, and their theologies that we've learned from the West reflect that context of war. And they were saying, and I think this was published in 1987, where the claim for theology in the Pacific need to be a theology of celebration. But celebration in the sense that we are not just happy people who, you know, dance and shake things around, but celebration as ritual. So it is what, if I understand the indigenous people in Australia, the emphasis on ceremony, it will be a similar way of thinking. It's for them in the 70s and 80s, in my father's generation, it's pretty much saying that our theology need to be different from the theology that comes from the West. And they use celebration as one of them. They use coconut as well. But one of the misunderstandings, in my humble opinion, of this theology, the coconut theology, is the assumption that it was meant to be a systematic theology. What I understand is that it's about being able to have communion and see this thing that the West considers to be unholy, that is a coconut, as the body of Christ, and always have an opportunity to drink and share the body of Christ, even if you don't have access to wine and bread. So that the coconut theology was more pastoral rather than systematic. It was about not just coconut, but breadfruit. You have talo, manioke, cassava, fish, to be able to celebrate local things as the body of Christ. That was the drive, wanting to push back at those Western big authorities. Don't force us to drink your wine and your bread. We have our own thing. And that is, for me, what it means to be a native. You need to be able to speak up. And this was very strong in the generation of my father, Nakorobi from what is called Melanesia. This thing, this spirit that I continue to push. We need to do it for ourselves. We need to name our values. And if we don't, somebody else will come and do it for us. And so that's the part of the inspiration that I continue to write as a Tongan, as a person of Moana, telling our story. This is us. This is how we want to celebrate. This is how we want to do theology. And it's no different from what I learned here in Australia with Aboriginal Indigenous theology, people who want to live and be post-colonial.
Reading your work, Sione, I've been reminded, though, of some of the crises that are very present in the Pacific, in the oceans at the moment. You've written about climate change and its impact. You've also written about the legacies of nuclear testing. I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit on what you think the challenges are now for Pacifica theology in that kind of context.
Let me just say, for the sake of what's called Pacific theology, to name that at the beginning of this development that led to coconut theology, nuclear testing and independence were the two driving forces of Pacific theology. It's only because coconut got written about and published that it became recognized, and then the other two things fell out. And it's only because of the World Council of Churches listening to my father that coconut theology became an issue and forgot about nuclear testing And I think we need to go back to that. You know, whenever there's a nuclear plant that has, like in Japan, in Fukushima, and all of these testing that have how many thousand of years half-lives of the toxicity of the nuclear waste, it continues. I mean, I'm ashamed to say that Tonga supports this deep sea mining that's happening now. The troubling of the waters is ridiculous. Let's just use that word. We need to find a way of dealing with that. It's a very painful thing to feel and think of the sea, of how the sea is being poisoned. And because the sea is not just a point of connection, it's the location, the center of our spirit world, the world of our spirituality. But how can we save the world, the land, without the sea? It's a heat sink, it's a carbon sink, but also an oxygen sink. So the related question is, what do we do in order to recognize the tapu, the sacredness of the sea?
What are your own reflections on that, facing these kinds of crises?
At the moment, I don't have any. But it's very difficult to work against political mentalities that have no regard for the sea. Yeah, I listen for the sea. I mean, that's I tell my friends that every time I go to Tonga for the first two or three nights, I won't be able to sleep. My family home is about 30 meters from the shoreline. I won't be able to sleep just because of the murmurs of the sea coming onto shore. So that's probably what I can do, is to listen for the sea. I hear the cries of the sea.
Sione Havea, a pastor from Tonga, speaking to me today from Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Sione is the author or editor of numerous books in post-colonial and Pacifica theology, including a commentary in the Earth Bible series on the story of Jonah and the Big Fish, as well as a new collection on theology from the Pacific to be published by Palgrave a bit later this year. What a wonderful guest to launch our new series on sacred landscapes, bringing seascapes to mind, along with a complex view of spirituality. Next time on Soul Search, we're continuing our series with a journey into the forest with a Theravadan Buddhist monk and a canopy biologist.
You're in a very hot, dry desert environment outside, and you get out of your four-wheel drive vehicle, or maybe you walk a mile because there's no road nearby, and you come to this green dot, and suddenly you go inside of the tree canopy, and it's humid and cool, and the birds are singing everywhere. It's just like going to a different planet. And you can appreciate in Ethiopia, that's what the priests believe. They are the stewards of all of God's creatures, as well as the human spirit, because when people go there to worship, they're transformed into this amazing Mother Nature sanctuary, and it's fabulous.
Dr. Meg Lohman, who you'll meet on Soul Search next week. She's one of the leaders of a project to preserve the church forests of Ethiopia. It's an incredible story in an era of widespread deforestation, and I hope you can join me again to hear it. For now, though, thanks to producer Hong Jiang and to Andre Shabanov for sound engineering. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'll be back with more sacred landscapes next time on Soul Search, right here on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.